digital fatigue, the death of proper journalism in a week that saw Donald Trump rise to the top of the Republican Party, questions are being asked over how the media could have got the race so wrong. Of course, journalism, when it's done right, is supposed to bring order to chaos, to cut through the white noise. Well, thankfully, there are still plenty of professionals looking beyond the dreaded clickbait and taking the longer view. And we'll be talking to them today on The Stack. Coming up in today's programme, we talk to a leading light in the slow journalism revolution.
We had a big year last year, we kind of doubled our sales last year, and I think part of the reason for that is that people are just starting to say, do you know what, actually enough of this white noise of information that's coming towards me. Let's have something kind of considered and curated.
Also ahead, from slow journalism to a European comic book classic, we'll hear from a Serbian government minister who's the cheerleader for a seminal story of secret agents.
They want to look like James Bond and 007, but unfortunately they're not smart enough, they're not good looking enough, they're not even capable enough, but they try.
All that plus a leaf through our magazine picks of the week. That's ahead on The Stack, Monocle 24's print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack. We welcome now one of our favourite regulars, Rob Orchard, editor of Delayed Gratification magazine, a prominent defender of slow journalism. The title takes a look back at news and current affairs from the previous 3 months in a more considered way. Hello, Rob. Good to have you with us again.
Very nice to be here, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's come back to, I guess, one of the sort of starting points of delayed gratification, which was this sense of, I don't know what you'd call it, ennui, digital fatigue, short-termism. Those were some of the drivers, I guess, for the project. Are they as true now? Are they truer now even than they were when you got started?
They're absolutely truer. So actually, when we were working on the idea in 2010, we launched in January of 2011. And actually, at that stage, I think the real thing that we were worried about was that people were still head over heels in love with digital and with the opportunities that it brought for ever greater speed in absolutely every area of their life. But particularly the worry for us was ever greater speed in news journalism and what that means in a context of a declining industry, you know, with journalists being given more and more stories to write with less and less time, with fewer and fewer resources, and what that means for the practice of good journalism. So definitely when we launched, the worry was that everything was going to be digital and there was going to be no space for print, and that because of the way that digital channels journalism, it was all going to be about snappy stuff and increasingly about listicles. We were just starting to kind of really get to grips with the horror
dread word. We might have to ban listicles at some point.
But listicles and clickbait and all this sort of nonsense. So I think actually now that fatigue that you talk about really has set in. We had a big year last year, we kind of doubled our sales last year, and I think part of the reason for that is that people are just starting to say, do you know what, actually enough of this white noise of information that's coming towards me. Let's have something kind of considered and curated, and that is finite as well, because that's the part of the challenge. You wake up in the morning and you're trying to read the internet every day, you can't actually get any work done because you're constantly being bombarded with updates from left, right and middle.
Well, and in these sort of early days of digital, people talked about, you know, it's almost unlimited, the choices, and that was always a positive.
Yeah.
But it's becoming a pejorative because you don't want limitless choices.
No.
And I think people actually want something that's edited, something that's curated. And that's certainly true with your title. But we shouldn't look at this in isolation. You know, we need to be in a commercially profitable business. These things need to make commercial sense. But I guess also what you are still finding is that people will pay, and they'll sometimes pay a premium, to get exactly the sort of experience you're describing.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, so we've always sold the magazine as almost like an experimental magazine. So it's a magazine without advertising that's supported uniquely by its subscribers. And with this quite powerful idea just to keep investing in better and better journalism, send people to more interesting places for longer periods and get richer and better stories as a result. And people have responded well to that. And obviously we're not the only people doing that. There's lots of people doing that. And of course, we didn't come up with that. That just used to be how things were before everything got in this race to the bottom caused by the internet. I suppose what was a bit weird 5 years ago is when we launched, we had kind of a cover price of £10. And the reaction to that, I mean, one of our associate editors, his grandmother, still, every time that he goes to see her, still says to her, have you still got a magazine?
It's £10. Do you know his magazine? It's £10. And I can understand that because, of course, you know, for a long time, magazines were either great supplements in broadsheets or they were kind of, you know, around the £2-3 mark. But that seems to have been kind of broken through. And actually, there's a lot of magazines now that are staking their commercial future on just charging the cost of the magazine plus a bit extra for profit rather than trying to co-op lots of kind of advertisers on board just by getting the sheer numbers.
And it's interesting, I suppose, a lot of readers, and we find this at Monocle, and in fact, with a lot of the mags that we also sell, delayed gratification amongst them at outlets like at the Kiosk Cafe operation in Paddington, not too far from here in London. People want to, they're happy to pay that premium because they view the magazine not as a piece of ephemera, but as a journal of record, as something collectible. And I can imagine you see, as we do with our black-spined monocles, you know, you see delayed gratification collections built up. That must give you a lot of satisfaction as
well. I love that. That's the nicest thing in the world. That's absolutely fantastic. Yes, you're absolutely right. And if you're going to ask people to pay a large amount of money, relatively speaking, for a magazine, then you just need to make it the best that print can be. So lovely kind of, you know, tactile paper stock and lovely kind of smell when you open it up. Not that I really like the smell just comes with it. I don't like inject it in. And, you know, kind of beautiful design, but you're right, that collectability is interesting, and it is a counterpoint to this other side of journalism over the last few years, which has been something is thrust into your hand at a tube station, something which people have kind of toiled over overnight and has been shipped in from printing works well outside the capital, and then you give it sort of 15 minutes of sort of slightly desultory flicking, and then you put it down and you leave it on the seat. I mean, what a nonsense that is, you know, that kind of super, super throwaway disposable publication.
Tossed to one side like an old sock.
Exactly like an old sock, yes. Although I would never throw an old sock on a tube train. I put it in the bin.
Because you're a considerate, you're a nice guy, Rob. Yeah. Let me talk a little bit about some of the things that people will know, or if they don't know, should learn more about in terms of delayed gratification. I think one thing that is hard to escape is the graphic element. Obviously, it's a beautifully designed magazine, but the infographics are a joy to behold. How does that work? Is that a commissioning effort? Do you get very involved? How does the sort of, what's the process of bringing those to the page?
We're very lucky. We have a fantastic art director, and the entire magazine is laid out by him, which means that it's all of a piece. It's kind of, you know, like Monocle. Part of the, I think, the reason that people respond well to our magazine, and I think also to Monocle, obviously, at a much bigger level, is because it is all one kind of design ecosystem, and a huge amount of time and effort is put into it, so it all feels of a piece. Infographics have always been a big part of what we do. They're a really good way to take 3 months of data and compress it into something that's kind of manageable. They've become a kind of a large part of our stock in trade. So what we have, as with any kind of editorial process, as you know, is just a colossal number of ideas on a wall at the beginning, a lot of which, when pursued even, you know, for a slight kind of distance, turn out to be disastrous ideas. So I can't tell you the number of infographics we started working on and felt all inspired about and then haven't kind of gone anywhere. I guess what we've done over the last 5 years is worked out a shorthand for them. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've done some that I kind of look back on and absolutely cringe, but we've learned a lot from that, and actually so now it's a much, much, much faster kind of process.
There's a refinement I guess that comes from experience.
Exactly.
Before we talk about some of the magazines that you brought in, there are a few handsome looking titles
there. Certainly are.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about another part of your model, which again I think strikes a chord with a lot of mags now in the sort of indie sector, and that's this idea of building a bit of a community with readers, with subscribers in particular. Why is that so important? Do you think that sense of a bit of a community builds a brand loyalty, which again is something that can be monetized, a horrible word, but you know, that's important. Or is it something bigger than that? Is it about a broader way of getting people to identify with the overall project?
It's all of the above, probably. We've always kind of looked on, so actually up until very recently we had very little social media presence. I've always admired Monocle for sort of steadfastly saying, you know, no Facebook, no Twitter, we've got a magazine, why do we need that? So we have, you know, we have used social media and so on. But I think much more interesting to us than a virtual online community of people who might occasionally click like on, you know, some pictures is a real community of people who've actually met up in a place, had an experience, had a cold beer together and had a bit of a chat. So what we've really, really been trying to do is turn a subscription into a membership. We hold these lovely slow journalism nights at the V&A, at the Design Museum. We get journalists to come down, talk about amazing stories they've been working on. We get to kind of hang out with people afterwards and have a drink, and that's nice. We're running free classes at our office at Somerset House for subscribers so they can learn how to make infographics. Those are always nice. We have pizza and cold drinks and they have 2.5 hours and people leave.
This is sounding beautiful. I want to wrap things up and go for a cold beer.
Let's go and learn infographics. Yeah. Slice of margarita.
Before we look at these other titles, then what's in the latest issue? And I don't know, I never want to ask people to reveal their secret planning for the future, but what's in the latest and what maybe a few things that might be coming up that are exciting?
Oh, fantastic, yeah. Latest issue, definitely the best one yet, issue 21. Some fantastic stories in there. So there were. I mean, I think this was an incredibly sad quarter, the quarter it was covered. So it was October to December of 2015. It was a time of a series of very major terrorist attacks. So there was Paris and there was Ankara and there was Beirut, San Bernardino. So we sent journalists back to all of those cities to report on the fallout from that, to see how stories had moved on. Mm. So we had people who were kind of at the Bataclan during the attacks in Paris and revisiting them and seeing what happened to them, and had this fantastic report from San Bernardino about what was happening in the city after this major disaster. We've got some slightly lesser known stories as well. There's an amazing story, blows my mind, about ketamine in the US. Ketamine, the horse tranquilizer, the club drug, which is now being prescribed to treat depression in the United States, and is having some amazing effects. So we've had somebody go to some of these unlicensed ketamine clinics and check out what the results are and check out what's going on. Amazing story, absolutely fantastic. So all sorts of good stuff.
A feast for the senses.
There is a feast for the senses. It sounds kind of slightly bleak, but there's also some nice funnies in there as well.
Light and shade. That's what you need for a bit of editorial balance. What about what's ahead, Nate? Yeah. You've mentioned obviously the events, and you know, I think people now familiar with the sort of the overarching ethos, but any things you can whet our appetites about?
Absolutely.
For Q1 of 2016, I guess it'll
be. Is exactly right. So it's January to March of this year. So we have a big story on Cologne, on the attacks that took place on New Year's Eve in Cologne, and what the fallout has been in Germany more broadly of having 1.1 million refugees arrive in the country in 1 year. We had one of our reporters go to the remote jungles of Central African Republic to meet with Louis Sano, who's this guy from New Jersey who has lived among the pygmies for the last 30 years. And we got sort of a semi-philosophical piece about driverless cars. There's this interesting moral conundrum that has to be grappled with when you're programming a driverless car, which is how you replicate through an algorithm the decision that a human being would take when they're driving along and they have to swerve to miss kind of like a gang of school children. But if they swerve, they'll swerve into a tree and they'll die. And so the moral decision is to die rather than doing that. But how do you... So this amazing thing where we're unpacking how you would actually set about coding that reflexive reaction into a car and whether you would even actually do that.
Robo-ethics, is that?
Robo-ethics.
Robo-morals, I'm not even sure. I'm still not very good on the difference between those two,
yeah,
which speaks volumes about me, probably.
Programming in cars.
Exactly. Rob Orchard from Delayed Gratification is here. Rob, now you've got a few... Well, you have a stack of magazines, appropriately
enough. I've got a stack of
magazines. Where do you want to start?
I want to start with this one, Drift. Do you know Drift?
I've seen the cover only, yeah, but I've not yet delved within.
So Drift was recommended to me by Steve Watson of Stack. When he told me about it, I thought it sounded awful. So it was very enthusiastic, but it's a magazine primarily about coffee. I was like, oh man, this is new hipster hell that I don't need to deal with. You know, like these awful conversations with people, you know, who are just sort of religious about coffee and goes on and on forever. And then I got the copy, handed it over, and I was like, oh man, this is brilliant. It's a city, a different city each time, so in this case Havana, seen through the lens of coffee, which again still sounds like hipster nonsense.
but bring us round.
But man alive, so this is made by a group of people who really know magazines. Mm-hmm. So the photography throughout is sensational. Reminds me a little bit of, you know, that sheer pleasure that Colours magazine takes in photography. And the stories are so brilliant. You know, actually, I sort of been absolutely captivated. There's a beautiful story about this guy who set off to walk to Guantanamo from Havana, and he falls in with this group of musicians. And this is the line where they got me into this magazine. So it said, I came upon the band one evening on stage in a city park playing slow, deliberate, antique music, something like a twisted, percussive, Napoleonic square dance. I was like, that's
I'm
great.
I'm on board.
I'm in with this. And so, yeah, a really, really kind of well-considered thing. And as with kind of the best sort of mono-theme magazines, what it does is it delves into the history and the philosophy and the economics. So, you know, actually there's this massive problem. Coffee is very much the lifeblood of Cuba, but because of long-term sanctions, because of the economic issues within the country, because of problems with crops, it's very, very difficult to get hold of. And so people have started cutting it with dried chickpeas and things like that. So brilliant. I'm so glad that Steve introduced me to it. I will absolutely be subscribing. It's biannual. So just kind of one of these lovely things that kind of comes
through. It's a beautiful thing I'm leafing through. And what's funny, actually, is, as you said, antithetical to that initial hipster fear.
Yeah.
It's kind of old-fashioned. I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Mm. Beautiful, just, you know, huge full-bleed portraits of Cubans at a coffee bar, wonderful pictures of the countryside. It's kind of a little bit, and even, you know, the typesetting is sort of pleasingly old school. So I mean, it's free of gimmicks, and it's actually just, again, it comes back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, I guess, about trusting to proper journalism, good writing.
Exactly right.
Lo and behold, good writing. Oh, it's a good magazine.
Exactly. Oh, it's so well done. I mean, it seems to be ad-free as well, so I hope that they're kind of doing okay, and I hope that it keeps going and building and building, because this is only issue 3, and usually on issue 3, there's all sorts of like bits falling off, you know? Yeah. But certainly our issue 3 was...
No sign of that. No sign of that. That's
beautifully done.
Where should we go next?
So I've got two magazines that I'd like to just kind of chuck at you in quick succession. One you will know, which is Granta, and one you may not know is Little Brother Magazine. Mm. It's a very nice literary magazine, sort of mix of stories and essays. The theme of this one is snacks, and so there's all sorts of fun stuff in here. There's a beautiful long story which starts off telling you all about the invention of Flaming Hot Cheetos. So apparently Flaming Hot Cheetos was invented by a guy who worked at Frito-Lay, and he was very junior. I think he was a janitor, and he'd had a really, really tough upbringing, and he came up with this fantastic idea, which was to make a very, very, very hot Cheeto, and it turned into a cultural phenomenon that made him a multimillionaire. But then the writer interweaves her own story with this story of Richard Montañez, the inventor of Flaming Hot Cheetos. And it's beautiful. And again, some kind of great writing in there. So the bit they got me here was slightly kind of more rough and ready, but it says, "The colour alone makes Flaming Hots look irritated. Flaming Hots would acquire a venereal disease and refuse to get it treated and then have sex with smart food and not tell it." And I was like, okay, yeah, excellent, great. And so they do, you know, it's this is not going to take you a huge long time to read. It's the sort of thing that actually, if you had a lovely kind of 2-3 hour coffee break, you could probably work your way through. Mm. And there are photo essays. There's a photo essay that kind of tickled me, which is a photo essay because it's around snacks. They got people to put one of those sour candies in their mouth and then have photos taken of them trying not to give it away.
I love this already, yeah. Brilliant. People look sort of, they vary from the sort of surprised to the absolutely haunted.
Exactly.
What a brilliant, that's a genius idea.
Yeah.
Or completely elated in some cases.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Let's not go there. Wonderful. Those are great pictures.
Very nice, you know, staged on the right side of Whimsy, very nicely put together.
Pop it in your handbag.
Pop it in your handbag, exactly the right sort of size.
Almost fit in a clutch.
Slip it in your skyrocket. And then you're all set. But I think, you know, a lovely one. And then, you know, I brought Granta as well. I always loved Granta for whatever reason. I haven't been picking it up for a long time. I think I haven't sort of seen it about the place. And I kind of rediscovered it recently. My God, it's a good publication. Mm. It's so well done. And, you know, if that's Little Brother, I think this is definitely Big Brother. It's possibly kind of the granddaddy of literary magazines.
Yeah. Big Brother, he's been away. Maybe he's got a doctorate.
Exactly, you know, right. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, got a few battle scars. But it's, it's just kind of, it's so assured. And obviously it's issue 135. The pedigree originally goes back to the late 1880s. Mm. And then I think there was a reinvention in the late 70s. But what a rewarding magazine. And it's quite interesting, you know, so if drawing kind of parallels between Little Brother and Granta, you know, they have a thing of people trying to hold a straight face while eating a sour candy. And, you know, these guys have got a very interesting in-depth piece about traveller community in Ireland. The whole issue that I've got is dedicated to Ireland. And they've got Roddy Doyle in there. And they've got, and I don't want to say his name because I don't know how to pronounce it, but they've got, I'm going to say, Colm Tóibín, which I'm certain is not right.
I think that's ballpark.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's not another Neem situation, is it?
It's tricky. It's a challenge, but that's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's impressive as well about Granta, I think people, you know, are aware of it, sort of, it's very important in literary culture, but they do, again, have these photo essays. And in a small format, you could maybe anticipate that, well, having, say, 4 landscape images on a small spread wouldn't quite work. But actually, again, it really comes together beautifully.
It comes good. I mean, these guys obviously have got their eye in after such a long time.
Yeah. They know what they're doing.
They know you're in safe hands with them.
135 in, which as one would hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Time is short, Rob. Let's just mention the other titles very briefly that you've got with
Absolutely.
You.
So two last titles, Remedy Quarterly, another intro from Steve. This is great. So this is recipes, but it's recipes prefaced by the story behind the recipe. So somebody spent an amazing transformative time working on this remote organic farm, talks about kind of, you know, what was going through their personal life, how they interacted with people, what the whole experience is, and it culminates in this description of the lunches they would have there, and then a recipe so that you can make that lunch. I was just thinking, that's really a brilliant way to do recipes. There's so many people doing recipes with so many kind of different slants on it, but actually telling the human story and telling what it meant to you when you're eating it, you know, is already going to give you pleasure when you start cooking it up yourself.
And I think it's broadcasting this kind of personal story, the illustrations, some really sort of charming, like naive art illos, which are just really, they're lovely and they really speak to that that exactly. kind of intimacy.
Exactly right. I think it's based out of San Francisco, a very nice thing.
Beautiful. And finally?
Finally, New Philosopher. So this is out of Australia. It's really good. So this is a magazine for people who studied philosophy at university, have completely forgotten all about it. okay. So the people including me, by the way, and would love at some level to regain that sort of interest and spark they had when they were a million years younger. The thing about this is, so it's not one of your dry academic philosophy magazines, of which there are plenty. It's a magazine of applied philosophy. So they seem to be taking two different angles. One is talking to philosophers about problems, you know, in kind of human life. And the other is talking to experts in other fields about their philosophy. So, for example, there's an amazing photo feature in there from a doctor, and it's part, I think it's taken from his book, and it's accompanied by an interview with him. So he did this whole series of portraits of patients, talking about their life story and what kind of had led them to the point where they came in through his surgery door. And him talking about his philosophy on life and on the end of life and on the quality of life and on health and so on, and on the health system, and all of these kind of, you know, questions about what we should pay for and what we shouldn't pay for, is absolutely brilliant. And lots of funny stuff in there as well. They've got a beautiful cartoon of the Philosophy World Cup, and you've got like the French intellectuals sitting on the grass drinking wine, and the Germans arguing over like the dialectics of a certain goal and so on. And it's a very nice production.
A beautiful thing.
Different theme every time.
Wonderful stuff. That's New Philosopher. Rob, an absolute pleasure to speak to you, as always. Thanks very much for guiding us through your stack of magazines here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Now, we were talking about slow journalism, about attention to detail with Rob, and there's no better examples of exactly those kinds of consideration, surely, than a comic book. And one such amongst them is the Alan Ford comic series. It's an Italian comic with an American name and setting which became a cultural phenomenon in Yugoslavia. Alan Ford is supposedly about a bunch of misfit secret agents called Group TNT, but in Serbo-Croat translation, it was widely read as a masterful satire with a rich vein of black humour which skewered capitalism and communism alike. Far from disappearing after the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, Alan Ford lives on with added resonance given the troubled economic times. In Serbia, the editor-in-chief of the company which revived the series and reprints old strips was Alexander Vulin. He stepped back in the past few years. He's been kept rather busy with his job as a government minister, but he's still Alan Ford's number one fan. Our correspondent Guy Delaunay met him and Croatian comics artist Igor Corday, who grew up on Alan Ford before going on to draw the X-Men, Captain America, and the Incredible Hulk.
My name is Alexander Vulin. I'm minister in government of Serbia. I'm minister for labor, social security. Alan Ford is a cult comic that have a cult status, but only in two countries in the world, Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, and Italy. We are probably only people in the world who understand what Alan Ford really stands for and what Alan Ford really is. Alan Ford is tall, blonde, good-looking, honest, and of course, dreadfully stupid. Bob Rock is small, big nose, extremely ugly, he's mean, he's dreadful, and he's probably one of the most beloved people because in this cartoon, because we are look like of him. He's a part of every of us. Who can say that he spent his life and that not be a little bit mean and not be a little bit jealous of guys who are taller or who are better looking? There is a group of absolutely desperate people who have absolutely no other means to achieve everyday bread. Not butter, bread, just bread. Of course, a guy who lead them have around 1,000 years, and more of that, he's absolutely great capitalistic exploitator. He even have some certain of charm, you know. All other people are wannabe secret agents, and they want to look like James Bond and 007, but unfortunately they're not smart enough, they're not good looking enough, they're not even capable enough, but they try.
I'm Igor Corday. I'm a comic artist and illustrator, and I'm doing this job for about 40 years. It came out in the 70s in Italy. They tried to sell it here and there, but it was never quite successful except in ex-Yugoslavia. And this heritage continued to go on and on. And I think the both Croatian and Serbian publishers, they probably reprinted complete Alan Ford serial for about 10, 15 times so far. And it's still quite popular because somehow people can identify with this weird sense of humor. People used to laugh on Alan Ford's jokes like 40 years ago because at that time Yugoslavia was kind of doing good. But nowadays they can really identify with this living on the edge thing, which is like main stuff in the complete serial, and especially this weird kind of humor, which was due to a brilliant translations of a Croatian editor who published it. He used to publish it the first time in the 70s, called Nenad Brixi, who was an amazing translator and a very, very like humorous guy. And people in Belgrade, they remember and repeat those sentences on Croatian language because it's like more funny to them than, you know, it's quite like unique stuff, quite a like real phenomenon. His comic book name was Magnus, the artist. He was like quite unique because Alan Ford, it was just one of his stints. He used to do lots of spy comics and erotics comics, and in Italy he was quite popular. But Alan Ford is something which you cannot relate to any particular style, because he managed to develop like something which resembles the even the old etchings, and even it's not something you can compare to any other living or dead comic artist today. But it's kind of with by this darkish tone, it resembles like late 50s American comics.
They cannot be just translation. You can do that with Google, but no, this you need the human touch. You need the touch of the guy who know by heart any comic episode in past 20 years. I'm that guy. So I know what the really meaning of this cartoon is, and I was guy who wrote that and tried to preserve remembering on Alan Ford in ex-Yugoslavia and transfer that for new generation. New generation are start to fall in love with Alan Ford. Because, you know, that character in Alan Ford are not a Democrat, are not a great fighter for the justice. They're not the knights. They're not even good people. They're just people. And every day living in Serbia, you can find so many of these characters. And especially we all live in capitalism. Alan Ford is one of the satiric picture of capitalism. I must underline that. They are not good people. They are not people who want to be. That's people how they are. Really, that they are our mirror. I'm most offended guy when I stand in front of the mirror. So Alan Ford is our mirror. You people in Great Britain or France or any other good, established and moderately rich country, you cannot understand Alan Ford ever. So I'm not sure why you bother, but great, great you ask.
Thanks very much, Guy, for bringing us up to speed and inside the pages of Alan Ford. And that is just about all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks, as always, to the team behind the show, our producers Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editor, Claire Urban. Drop us a note, info@monocle.com is the email you need, and don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.